are listening to 99.1 WQRT LP Indianapolis, and this is Create Here. Produced by artists and curators from Big Car Collaborative, Create Here is your place to listen to conversations with people making intriguing, innovative, and impactful things happen on the cultural front in Indianapolis, Indiana, and beyond. Find out more and access additional episodes at WQRT.org.
This is Jim Walker, and I am here with Jim Lindler, the president of Alan Y. Hochul's Charitable Foundation, based here in Indianapolis. Thank you for joining us, Jim.
Thanks. Great to be with you, Jim. And we can say Jim all over. That's right.
That's right. So the two Jims. So I think one of the things that prompted us having this conversation, and there are multiple things we want to talk about, is the idea of demystifying a little bit about philanthropy.
Right.
And I had a good conversation recently with Ernest Disney Breton from the Arts Council, who we saw each other at his celebration. And he and I talked quite a bit about how philanthropy is such an important thing, but sometimes people don't understand it who are in the general public. And they might not know who these names are. So Alan Y. Hochul's is a real person.
Right. He lived to be about 84, 85 years old and died in the year 2000.
And he was a friend of yours too.
He was a friend. The last 20 years of his life, my wife and I were in Indianapolis and we knew each other well, Alan and I. And then immediately following his death, the foundation, which he had founded before, so it would be, you know, kind of legally constituted, his estate funded that. And since then, I've been a director and then came back and I'm now the president CEO type for the foundation.
So you were on the board of at its origin?
Almost. Okay. Not quite at its origin, but within a couple of years.
And when, you know, so disclosure that you are a funder of our, Alan White Clues, and you are a funder of our work. When we were very new, we heard about this really kind of a different sort of funder who takes a lot of chances in terms of experimenting out with new ideas or newer organizations. And that's always been the philosophy from the beginning. Is that right?
From the beginning, right. You know, we do the traditional and large and many of the arts organizations that Alan cared about during his lifetime. Yeah. And he was the son of two philanthropists, Dr. and Mrs. Clues' parents.
Yeah.
But we also realized almost from the get-go that as much energy as there is in large and or existing arts institutions and arts organizations, that there's, you know, arts are all about bubbling creativity.
Yeah.
And that bubbling creativity was happening in lots of new ways as well as continuing ways. And as I often like to say, and, you know, sitting here in your radio station is like sitting in a mecca of it, is that we discovered that in new organizations, and actually part of the transformation of continuing organizations, was that arts and community and human development really go together hand in hand.
Yeah.
And so that was, as I say, kind of from the get-go.
You were telling me that you had a connection with radio yourself, and that's part of what prompted us to do this interview. We were talking about the station and you mentioned, so for how long and where did you do this?
Right. Well, my lesser radio experience was working in the radio station in college, which was really great and great fun.
Which college did you go to?
I went to DePauw University over in Greencastle.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
And as I say, it was just great for arts and learning and what I ended up doing in life, too. It was a great foundation for that.
Yeah.
But the last radio and media experience that I did was the radio station in Greenwich, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. Was invited. There was a wonderful, wonderful woman who did a show kind of like this and would do conversations. And so we started doing those, and I was a pretty regular guest. And my very best clergy friend in Greenwich, Connecticut, I loved all of my, you know, sort of Christian church friends, to be sure, but my best friend was the rabbi at the temple next door to the church that I served.
Yeah.
And we did everything together. We did Holy Land trips. I preached at his kid's bar mitzvah, you know, which is an unusual unusual for to ask the priest next door to do.
Right.
But then our wonderful friend said, you know what? Why don't you and Rabbi Midge do a weekly show? So we did. And yes, it was about kind of faith traditions and especially the openness and the collaboration of faith traditions instead of what you sometimes hear about, you know, the one-upsmanship and competition when it comes to different traditions of faith.
Yeah.
And we always rooted it in the context of what was happening in that community and the context of what was happening in American life as well. So we did that. I was in Greenwich for 10 years, and I bet we did that for 8 years.
Wow.
And we had a pretty good listenership too, and a lot of feedback that was good.
So you were doing basically a podcast before.
That's right. Yes. And, you know, I still am learning what a podcast is. I one time did an ecumenical organization called Day One in America that started out actually during the Second World War, broadcasting sermons that would be helpful to troops all over the world, but then continued. And you can still listen to these, in fact, on Day One. And I did several over the years, several of those and that sort of thing. And towards the end of the time I was doing those, when I was in Connecticut, in fact, the director of that said, you know, we would do interviews like this as well as, you know, kind of preaching over the radio, more conversation.
Right.
That's the way I view what that purpose is.
Yeah.
And he came to me one day and he said, you know, Jim, you have the most popular podcast of all. And I, what was the question then? What's a podcast?
Right. You know?
So I keep growing with the help of my children, particularly.
Right. I think it's just a new name for what you were already
That's
doing.
That's right.
Yeah. It's important, I think, for organizations like ours and people who are doing maybe unusual things to have somebody who's coming from, I remember the first time your colleague, Bill Marshall, who he went to see him in his office. You don't know when you're going into that setting that this is an organization that is pretty very open-minded and into, so you look around and it's in an office and it's a guy wearing
right.
a suit and you're like, well, maybe he's...
And a wonderful portrait of Alan hanging over
right.
it. So yeah.
Yeah. And you
in his library yet.
Right. And you don't know if what you're talking about is going to resonate with this organization. And then all of a sudden it does. And then later I've gotten to know you and Liz and other people on your staff. Mm-hmm. And we have understood this culture, but at first you don't know that. And, but as you look at the things you support, it becomes really clear.
And I think that's one of the, as you say, you know, in our kind of general public life, we're not sure what philanthropic institutions and organizations are, what foundations mean, how they are different and how approachable they can be. And we don't also, I think a lot of times, don't really own the fact that you don't have to be a multimillionaire to be philanthropically minded, that
right.
it's all about generosity. It's all about, you know, the Greek meaning of the word is loving humanity for philanthropy. And that's what the goal is to show love of humanity, and any of us can do that
right.
with the resources and the gifts that we have.
And it's a really good example that for Alan Whitehill Clues to have given this gift that keeps on going for so long.
Yeah, that's the purpose of a foundation is a private foundation has public purpose to it, which is to continue to utilize those resources so that you can support that generativity and creativity and strengthening of organizations and people.
So as a way to kind of talk about a great example of what you support and what comes from the Clues family, is I recently had a great experience out at Newfields in the IMA, seeing the Clues Pavilion and it's sort of...
Redone.
Yeah.
That's it's really not your
great.
Dad's Buick anymore.
Right.
You know?
So when these ideas were coming about, I bet you didn't take 2 seconds to think, that sounds awesome.
Right. That sounds awesome. And that was one of the times that these two sister foundations came together.
Yeah.
The Clues Fund is the older foundation, doesn't have as great a resource as the Alan Whitehill Clues Charitable Foundation does. But the Clues Fund has been the owner out of the estate for all of that wonderful art that has been given over a period of years to Newfields. But together, because we both have funded that and we both funded the renovation and the total transformation and reimagining of what the how the collection would be presented in and a really cool ceiling that is alive, you know, electronically. We did that work together. So we get a lot of time to be with the Newfields leadership, and particularly with the people who are the curators for the Clues Pavilion. And we were part of that step by step, which was as much learning as it was, you know, kind of the giving of observation. And so the opening has really reflected that. And Shel Wagenstein, who is one of the primary curators for the Clues Pavilion and did that reimagining. He and I are now, is this a commercial message? You don't have to pay anything for this, do you, Jim? He and I are now doing on the first Thursdays, which are the days without admission charge. We're doing these conversations with people that either groups that come in or kind of pop-up conversations about how art is about conversation and dialogue between different cultures and within one's own spirit and the art that a person is experiencing. So, I mean, this really has been something that launched a whole new thing.
And it was a neat story in part because I had gotten to know David Rubin, who did a plan through his company for sort of how to create these gateways and access inside and outside of this the property there at Newfields. And I had heard that they were going to make a way to get back in there. Because it used to be kind of, you had to know.
Right, you did. And so the visitorship went way down, you know, the percentages. So they did all of that kind of study for us. And that's because when Newfields was built in the late 60s and was built on what was a Lilly family estate at that point, the major building was built. But the idea was going to be that there would be disconnected arts pavilions. And the only one that was ever built that way, and because it was the first one, was the Clues Pavilion. But then that became a problem. And part of what we've worked on, you know, everything is about access, I think, in this day and age. And so we made a grant to allow access so that you could go straight back and really say, wait, this is part of the whole experience, isn't it, to be doing that. And it's very, very different. I'm glad to hear you say that you had that experience.
Well, it was a really nice experience because it was the opening of the 18 Collective.
Oh, yeah.
These are the artists who did the Black Lives Matter mural, and they each had their own pieces in the show in a gallery space just around the corner. And one of the things that happened is that we walked back into there, and a lot of the folks who had come to that opening were hanging out in that big open space, sitting in these little lounge chairs and looking up at the ceiling, which changes, like it looks like the sky.
Basically. Yes, it does. And you can also, you know, I mean, you program it. This is about as technological as I get, you know, it's talking in a microphone that someone else is really doing the work. But it can be programmed so that it can represent art that is, that you're having an experience of at the same time. But a lot of it is about the outdoors environment and ambiance that is so much a part of Newfields as well.
And it was an experience in that space where people were talking with each other. So the social element that you're mentioning is really fostered by that. And when I was in there before, years past, nobody was probably hanging out there talking with each other.
And you know, you have this sort of taboo thing about you're supposed to be quiet in an art museum or a library. Well, actually, no. And so, and when that was built, though, back in the early 1970s, they built that huge atrium space for that kind of gathering purpose and for music and for performance as well as for visual art. But now I think it's really, I mean, you know, how many years later is this? 50 years later, it's really living into that sense of what it's meant for.
So in that space also gives you a little feeling of what it was like to maybe be growing up, because it's, if you're Alan, because that was connected to the home of the family?
Right. The at first, when Dr. Clues, who was the first research director of the Lilly Company here in Indianapolis, and he was an avid lover of the arts, and particularly collector of paintings and other art, and loved music as well. When he began that work of collecting, recollection, it was all in their house. And houses that are kind of big often have a name to them. And that name was Westerly, was the house and the grounds that the Clues family lived on. When he died, the first thought was, gosh, maybe we can open the house up on occasion in order to be that kind of public museum. Right. But it's not like the famous Stuart Museum in Boston, you know, which is in a space where the public can gain easy access to it.
Right.
So the decision was made to, over a period of many years, gradually give the art to the museum, build the pavilion. But they wanted it to have that kind of housey, domestic sense for two reasons. One, because they really, that's how they had experienced the art, was in the house and domestic. And the other was, they were very, very hospitable people. And I think they thought that art had to do with hospitality too. And so to give something that was of the scale and sense of, you know, welcome home, welcome here, is important to them.
And I don't think I understood that until, because I have had an opportunity to visit the Stuart Gardner Museum that you're talking about in Boston. That's what was a home that's expansive, weird place.
It and is then, very weird.
Yeah, and then the Barnes is another one in Philadelphia where they took that. It's a very similar idea. This one is in a new building, but they took the exact home interior and moved, like redid it.
Yeah.
And there's the Taft Museum also in Cincinnati that's similar. So when you don't know the context of that, it doesn't maybe make as much sense to all of a sudden see these wood paneled walls and like the fireplace and stuff. Mm-hmm. But as you know that and you understand the connection, it really does feel a lot more welcoming, actually, because you're kind of in this home.
That's great
space.
To hear. I mean, that, and that is its intent, to be very, very welcoming. And now with how this is developing, welcoming not just as an observer, but really as an engaged conversationalist and participant in the experience of the art.
And I noticed they installed some more activities in there to kind of engage people. Like
To engage people. I love the electronic book that depicts the Clues family story. Yeah, it's really neat, and how the pages change in that way and tell a wonderful story. And the beginning of the philanthropy was in the area of arts, but also it was in the area of really betterment of community life in Indianapolis. And you'll see one of the first lists of the grants that were made by the Clues Foundation.
Oh, nice. So how did you connect at first with Alan and the family?
Well, I am a long time now recovering clergy person of the Episcopal Church, having served in that function.
Yeah.
And I first met Alan when I worked at the cathedral that's on the circle. And he would come and do some things. And this was back in the 70s when I was very young and recently ordained. And then went to serve Trinity Church and St. Richard's School, which is at 33rd and Meridian, which is kind of a twofold reality. One is it's the, you know, it's where Alan went to church. It's where his parents went to church. But they also had a major artistic role in that. They decided that, and it's well worth visiting. It's kind of like a different dimension of the Clues Pavilion experience. Mrs. Clues, Alan's mother, and some other folks from Trinity and from the city of Indianapolis, following the Second World War, went to England and said, you know, we want to study these kind of early Gothic churches that are parish churches in England, see what they, how they are living art pieces too. Yeah. So they did that and then came to Indianapolis and built one.
Wow.
And used craftsmen that used the same kind of things and then did beautiful decoration of that period and great polychroming and painting of the wood. And in fact, Mrs. Clues and some of her friends, we have photographs of her helping to do that. So I knew Alan for the almost 20 years that I served Trinity. And, you know, we were much younger, obviously, but also good friends and had the opportunity, as I'm an amateur musician and love arts in other ways, too. We spent a lot of time in two ways. One was enjoying the arts, yeah, visual and performance. And the other was, Alan was utterly devoted, as was his mother, to gardens and how they have spiritual power to them. Yeah. And so we spent a lot of time in the garden too. And occasionally I would dig, because I always dig wherever my wife tells me, but she and Alan would sometimes do some gardening together at Westerly, the house he lived in.
That's amazing. So then you were able to be there with him as he, because he was getting involved in supporting some things then.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And making, and including some things with Heron, the old, the original, and that sort of branched off into Heron School, but also into
the
what's now Newfields.
Right, what's now Newfields. And really, he was for many years, for decades, the president of the Clues Fund, the earlier foundation and the older of the two foundations, until really maybe 2 or 3 years before his death. And so he loved that philanthropy, and hence that was, I think, and we talked about it a bit, what really captured his heart in saying, no, I want my legacy to be something, and not with lots of strings attached, because some of us knew Alan, but, you know, a board of directors makes these kinds of decisions. But I want to leave something to the community that can be used for beauty and art and for upbuilding kind of the human soul in that way.
So for you personally, what was your transition from working in a church to going in this direction? So
I had always in my, or at least for a great bit of my church work, had a kind of parallel life in philanthropy. Mm-hmm. We had, as the church that Alan went to, had a grants program of its own that was part of the legacy and gifting of another philanthropist known as Eli Lilly, who did that.
That program still exists in and we did receive a grant from the church.
Yeah. From the church, isn't that cool? Yeah. Because a lot of churches don't have the capacity or really the kind of vision to want to do that.
Yeah.
But we found that important.
Yeah.
You know, down the street from 32nd Street to 28th Street was the Lilly Endowment. So I did a lot of kind of consultation and work, particularly in the areas of leadership at that point, and have done consultation with other foundations here and there. So it's been a part of my life. And when Alan went to the next life and left this largesse to be something of creativity and hope, being a director those years, and the timing was just right. Bill Marshall, wonderful friend and mentor in many ways, you know, he was ready to be emeritus, and it was a good transition for me to become the president.
And what were you doing out in Connecticut? So you had moved.
Right. So we were gone for 20 years. And the first half of that time, roughly, I was the president of a seminary, of a divinity school, the Episcopal Divinity School that's in Chicago, Seabury Western Seminary. And then did kind of a bridge of some work from Evanston, but also worked for our national denomination, the offices being in New York.
Okay.
And then got to be again in a congregation, because I really love people and love congregations and how creative they are, and one that was also focused very, very much on the arts in Connecticut, in Greenwich, Connecticut, and did that until it was kind of time to put that trek of many decades aside and come back to Indianapolis and do this.
Well, we're really, really glad to have you back.
Oh, wait, that's very kind of you to say.
So you mentioned before that you're a musician.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your instrument and what you like to play.
Well, my primary instrument is piano, and but you know, you play harpsichord and organ when you do that kind of keyboard sort of thing, and a couple of lower brass instruments that were more really amateur hobbies, even during school and college and that kind of thing.
Like the tuba?
A trombone and baritone horn, you know, which was great fun. And I love that. I'm an only child, but I had a set of cousins who were also loved music and were very talented musicians themselves. So we did a lot of stuff together.
Yeah.
And yes, I did marry my high school sweetheart,
nice.
Who is one of five girls in her family that also are all string players. So we used to have these little kind of orchestra things ourselves as kids and growing up through high school and the like. And then I went to college and started out in the music school, but I realized that that wasn't my call, and that spending, if you're really going to be good, 5 or 6 hours a day in a practice room wasn't my was not very congruent with my extroversion as a in my personality.
Yeah,
but it's always been very important. The college I went to was not one that had a huge music school, but if you left the music school per se, you could still do almost all the musical stuff. I love accompanying and playing and doing jazz as well. That's an important part of my musical delight.
Your background really connects well with collaboration, because in music, you usually don't just, I mean, sometimes there are solo musicians, obviously, but the fun part, it seems like, you is playing with other people.
But always has been, in fact. In fact, I was back at the college that I went to the other evening for an event, and the president of the university gave a wonderful little welcome and that, and then invited me to say something, you know, so I didn't. I said, well, actually, I think it was 53 years ago this week that I came to play my audition for the music school, and it was a great experience. And afterwards, the head of the piano department said to my mother, well, Mrs. Lemler, he plays Rachmaninoff really well. And don't worry, we'll calm down his Mozart. So that's been kind of a mantra for my life ever since. If you, Jimmy, calm down your Mozart.
That's great. And your time with the church is also very collaborative.
Oh, it has been
The denomination that you're from is a very... inclusive
and
progressive one, from my understanding.
Right. Yeah.
And my experience with that church is I have friends who go there, and I've been to some baby dedications and things there.
Right.
It's a great place.
It's a historic space,
but it's also really alive now.
Lively, and it's rooted in its context and its neighborhood. One time, Alan gave an interview for the Indianapolis Star, which was really reflective of, you know, his love for art, but also how much he loved the urban setting of things. He said, I'm happy to say that I work, worship, and live south of 38th Street. You know? So it's kind of an urban sense that church, which they had so much to do with, and he has over his years as well, really tries to manifest that context awareness.
And this is Christ Church Cathedral, located on the Circle.
And then Trinity Church was his home parish at
33rd Street.
Yeah, 33rd Street.
So these are both, they're sort of peer, or not peer, but within the same denomination.
Right, and very similar organizations. And both had... philanthropists, interestingly enough, that were part of the congregation. So, you know, the most famous philanthropist at Christchurch was Eli Lilly.
Yeah.
And at Trinity, it's interesting, the families that in those days were part of the congregation included the Clues and the Pulliams and the Fairbanks and folks who, you know, you look now and suddenly, not suddenly, this all happened sort of 20 years ago, in fact, in kind of a transition. There's wonderful philanthropy and work that is extended quite broadly in this community out of their giving and their legacy.
In your work, one of the things that you're doing is preserving that legacy for Alan and for the Clues family. What are the things that you would want people to know about him that as a person? So we know about what you're doing to support all kinds of arts organizations and other organizations in the city to build community and preserve all these things. Him as a person, are there things that people should know?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. He I would want to say never married, but he was married for a very brief period of time. And then I think there was a mutual sense that this isn't really what we're called to be.
Yeah.
And so as a single person in the city, he really had a sense with those who needed friendship in order to make meaning of their lives, which we all do.
Yeah.
But I think he had a particular awareness of that. He knew he loved beauty. In fact, he kept for several years an office at Newfields as well, because he was intimately involved with the collection and with the art museum and other ways. And he knew the power of beauty. He knew that it helps to heal and to transform. And that was true of beauty, of performance and of visual arts and of folk art and the like. And those were really important to him. And the other thing is, like I said, you know, the context, gosh, I work, worship and live south of 38th Street.
Yeah.
The other thing, which when I was writing a little article for him for the Indianapolis Historical Society and the new book of Indianapolis history that came out, I found that he was the president of an organization, the purpose of which, and had modest effect, but the purpose of which was to keep Highway 65 from demolishing the urban communities in which he lived.
Yeah.
And Indianapolis is for everyone, you know.
Wow.
And so that was a part of his spirit too, and we knew that very well. He was a good and in lots of ways a gentle soul too. Although he certainly had his opinion on stuff, and he could express that well.
And for context, for people who don't know, this south of 38th Street and the highway stuff in the 70s, which is probably when a lot of this was going on, people had pretty much had in many ways abandoned south of 38th.
South of 38th Street. And then when Highway 65 was built, the decision was made to do with it what it did. And this was true of cities all across America. It went through urban areas without really regard for or respect for the communities that were there.
Yeah.
And that has been a further challenge and really disservice to urban communities. And so part of what we see in arts groups like Big Car is the ability to be respectful, responsible, creative, imaginative urban citizens at the same time. And that's so, so great for us, knowing that the arts have expanded as well into what now I guess we call metropolitan Indianapolis.
Right. And that there were lots of people down here, but what was abandoned was the care
for this place
and for the folks who live
in the world of philanthropy and social service. They often refer to the underserved, which is quite too polite a word to describe people that were disregarded and alienated in many ways.
Right. And that's changed a lot. And a lot of the attention has come to grassroots work that is happening in these smaller places, which brings us back to what we started out talking about, which is that does take a different approach, because if you're going to an institution that has a whole department of development, they're filling out grants and doing all these things in a certain way. And then if it's a smaller organization like ours, you might have one or two people involved in that. And there's different or even smaller groups than ours, where the person who's doing the janitor work is also doing.
And we really, we take a certain delight in that we have regular granting relationship with all of the kind of organizations that you just described, in fact, because that's so important, again, to the human spirit and to the way that people collaborate and create community, which art is at its best does.
Right. And I had a good experience running into you at Butter.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Wow. Was Butter fantastic
So these are things that are just brand new, just in the last couple of years happening. So it's a very exciting time in our city for these reasons that there is a lot of new stuff happening that's very powerful.
That's right.
And you're able to get to support that.
Right. And to be, you know, I mean, generosity is such, you know, it's one of those primary dynamics and dimensions of human life. And when I left the music school in college, I read classical languages and philosophy. So I was, you know, I'm kind of like the guy in My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where I think that everything comes from the Greek language or right. the Latin language. You know. But from the Latin language, the word generosity has as its root, you know, genus, from which we get the basic fabric of our being and our, right. you know, so it's really right. about living out our being in a way that gives the generous one a sense of purpose and relationship, and gives to those to whom generosity is shown a way of strengthening and sustaining that it takes a whole community to do.
Well, I want to thank you for your generosity, both with your time today.
Well, thank you.
And also just all you do yeah. for our community
well,
and
thank
with
you.
Our community.
I do it with lots of other people. We have a fabulous board and a great staff, and you know almost all of them.
Yeah.
And part of what we delight in doing is this kind of conversation. And also, we've really upped our commitment to being present with in the arts performances and the arts experiences and communities in the city. And that's, we see as an equally important part of our philanthropy and generosity.
So I think one neat way that we could kind of leave this
yeah.
that I just thought of too is a song. What's a song that you're listening to now or that you love? That or that you like to play, and we can play
oh
that song
gosh.
As a way to kind of end.
You know, it's different arenas of song for me.
Yeah.
So I was thinking this morning, because we're planning, as I mentioned to you, I'm consultant for a wonderful leadership project in Detroit that is working. And I'm going to underplay the piano on some stuff, because
nice.
It's a very mixed in terms of faith, tradition, and race group that we're going to have in this residency.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was humming, and I was ready. If a keyboard had been around, I was going to go play Lead Me, Guide Me, which is a great African-American spiritual. I'm devoted to the American Songbook and glad that the American Songbook Institute is here in Indianapolis. And so I would suppose that at the very top of my list of jazz things that I like to do from the American Songbook is Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Nice.
And then I also like opera stuff, but don't worry about that right now.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jim. And if people
thank
want
you.
To learn more, they can find Alan Weihill Clues online. You're
right.
The Foundation. There's also, I noticed, a very good detailed article about Alan in the Encyclopedia of
right,
Indianapolis,
encyclopedia,
which is
yes.
another thing that you've supported.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And people can really
yes.
learn a lot about the history of Indianapolis right. and also learn more about Alan himself
right.
through that.
Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you so much,
Thank
Tim.
You. Great being with you today.
You too.